I'm Frank Vaughn. It's May 5th, 2025, and I feel, with so many people losing track of the script as we await the May 26th reconvening Parliament, it's a good time to continue our review of Mark Carney's book, Values. There's also a lot of Western politicians that seem to be wanting to get ahead of any nascent separatist movement or separatist inclinations. Carla Beck says, Carla Beck is the leader of the Saskatchewan NDP, Saskatchewan joined Confederation on September 1st, 1905. That was 43,710 days ago. She's a proud Canadian, and that's never going to change. And I responded, 43,710 days of struggle against Ottawa, a struggle that goes back long before Saskatchewan joined the Federation. Who is Carla loyal to, Saskatchewan or Canada? If the latter, then she is in the wrong branch of politics. Provincial leaders, loyalty should be to their province first. Otherwise, get into federal politics, because the federal government has been consistently screwing the West of this country since before they were provinces. So it's time we wake up. It's time we allow voices to be heard. And her response to Scott Moe, who hasn't even indicated support for a separatist movement, there's a lot of hysteria that's sweeping the land. He's merely said that people's voices should be heard. And isn't that what we're all about in a democratic Canada, even though we're a constitutional monarchy? Shouldn't voices be heard? And in pursuit of consistency with this objective, we're going to continue listening to Mark Carney's voice. He's our prime minister, and this is his book. Continuing, this is part five of this series examining values. Financial technology to ensure that every financial decision takes climate change into account, so that the principal factor in every single purchase you make will be the impact on climate change. What is climate change? CO2. Every time you breathe, you produce it. Remember that. This requires a fundamental reordering of the financial system so that all aspects of finance, investments, loans, derivatives, insurance products, whole markets, systemically take the impact of their actions on the race to net zero. The objective is a financial system in which climate change is as much a determinant of value as credit worthiness, interest rates, or technology, where the impact of an activity on climate change is a new vector, a new determinant of value. Does anybody understand what a fundamental restructuring of society Mark Carney represents? An existential threat to the very livelihoods of the people who live in Western Canada, not to mention other places. Because even the mining industry, which is prominent in BC, involves the production of a large amount of CO2. He wants it to be as much a determinant of value as creditworthiness. So your ability to repay a loan that you take will be equal to in determining whether or not you get that loan or whether or not you can make that investment as climate change itself. And here he says this little quip, and it requires the creation of some new markets. Now, what is he talking about when he says market creation? He's talking about the government stepping in and dictating how you can and can't spend your money. This should be a clear theme if you've watched the other four parts of this series. He believes that not just the government, actually, that central banks themselves can have a central role in the creation and dissolution of markets, determining who the winners and losers are from on high and telling private money how it can spend itself, how it can invest itself, what it can do and what it can't do. And by the magic, well, you're going to find out about the magic. Another quote, when society places emphasis on solving a problem, the private sector swings into action, coming up with solutions that public authorities could not have imagined and implementing them with a speed and competitive zeal that continually surprises. So remember from the other parts that he declares the market to be behind the evils of the world, not banking, not finance, not anything else, not even human hands. The market itself is the problem. There's not enough rigid control. But here he is saying that politicians, public policy wonks, can dictate the terms of the market, and then the market itself, the private economy, private sector, swings into action and miraculously comes up with all the solutions. So The government determines the parameters, and then it's left to the private economy to come up with the solutions. So the government, admittedly, right here, the central banks, right here, finance, right here, don't have the answers. They're just going to tell you what the answers need to be, and it's up to you to solve for them. It's up to you to find them. It's up for you to fill in the blanks. Continuing, in 2015 at COP21 in Paris, following a call from the G20 and the FSB, established the Private Sector Industry-Led Task Force on Climate-Related Financial Disclosures under the leadership of Michael Bloomberg, one of those oligarchs we keep talking about that Mark Carney so well represents. Here he is bragging about the coalition of oligarchs. The TCFD recommendations are a solution for the market, by the market, not Main Street, not the market interactions that you and I as plebs have to deal with, but the market of the ultra-rich, the oligarchical class, which is why I always call, people call Mark Carney a communist and a socialist, and they call him all these names. He is a technocratic oligarchical collectivist. To understand oligarchical collectivism, you need to read Orwell, and to understand technocracy, you simply need to read Mark Carney. They are supported by financial institutions controlling balance sheets totaling over $170 trillion, with a T, including the world's largest banks, pension funds, asset managers, and insurers. Now, isn't that interesting that he decides to list banks, pension funds, asset managers, and insurers as the most important innovators? They're not building anything. We're not talking about factories here. We're not talking about farmers here. We're talking about money pushers, the people that he thinks are completely normal at the top of the pyramid. The disclosure recommendations deliver actionable information that will be useful in decision-making by a company's management, its investors, and its creditors. So let's assume you are a company that actually makes things and builds things, or you're a tradesperson that has employees in the same trade, and you're going to the bank for a loan. What Mark is talking about are the people who are going to provide you the capital so that you can do things, and talking about how they're going to frame the decision as to whether you survive or you don't survive, whether you have access to credit or investors, around the net zero concept, around climate change. These are the unofficial governors of your lives, the people who can create money and pick where it gets distributed. Investors need to weigh options against a range of possible transition paths, from the catastrophic business as usual to a smooth and timely transition to net zero. This does not present the possibility that CO2 is not the primary pollutant du jour, that there might actually be a degree of alarmism. He accepts the alarmism. He accepts the predetermined nature of the IPCC and other people who push climate alarmism, which is that if there's any science that suggests that CO2 is not the principal driver of climate, it is not allowed to be heard. He is a climate radical unlike anything Canada has ever seen, because he understands the objectives. He understands climate radicalism and what it can do for the oligarchy, and he isn't stupid. There's a lot of commentators out there who talk about Mark Carney being a clown. This man is not a clown. He's brilliant. He's not like Justin Trudeau. Justin Trudeau wasn't really leading. He was a narcissist in a position of power, and the rules were bent because he had that magical last name so that he could keep himself there, and there wasn't really a mechanism for the Liberals to remove him, which is why so much pressure was required to get him out of office. He wasn't a genuine leader. He had, one could argue, speaking capabilities. He certainly hypnotized enough of the Canadian public, but he outlived his usefulness. Mark Carney's here to rule, folks. Rule directly. Not rule on behalf of. Rule directly as a member of the ruling class. Whereas Trudeau is a guest. He was a useful idiot, more than anything. Like a lot of the people in government are useful idiots. Mark Carney's not a useful idiot. He's one of the ringmasters. In a few short years, the TCFD has become the gold standard for climate reporting. Demand for it is enormous, including from every major systemic bank, the world's largest insurers, pension funds, and asset managers, comprising in total over $150 trillion in assets. And once again, you need to understand that in his mind, banks, pension funds, and asset managers are the only people that matter. He does not talk about Main Street. He does not talk about manufacturing. He does not talk about the importance of building things. In his mind, the paper pushers and the money creators are the drivers of the economy. And why would the TCFD become the gold standard? It's because the oligarchical class has applied a lot of pressure on national governments to adopt this farce and to call anything that challenges the farce heresy, to basically render it publicly unacceptable to challenge the orthodoxy. So, of course, if you're a financial institution, asset manager, or pension fund, and you're looking at being blacklisted, which is what these organizations do, is they rate you like a social credit score, and you end up on a blacklist where nobody wants to take your money or nobody wants to put money into you. Of course, if there's massive pressure from the apparatus on high, you're going to comply. That's the demand. It's not organic demand. These aren't organic markets. These are creations. They're artificial constructs. Artificial constructs, and they're enforced by coercion. Now it's time to make TCFD disclosure mandatory. Socialism. Idea is so good, they have to be mandatory. They love that word, mandatory. If you've watched my four parts already, you understand that Carney is in favor of massive, overwhelming responses from the top down. Finally, although the time horizons for physical risks are long, addressing major climate risks tomorrow requires actions today. Indeed, actions over the next decade, probably in the next 3 to 5 years, will be critical to determining the size and balance of future risks. So I highlight this part just to say that his time horizon falls within his first term as prime minister. He's not talking about 2050. We're not talking about 2030 anymore. We're talking about the end of industry, the end of oil, the end of gas, and the end of the internal combustion engine within his first term. I think that's a vastly unrealistic objective, and he might come out and make public policy statements that deny this. But he wrote this book, and this book is our best asset in terms of understanding what he actually is driving towards. Continuing, over the next 3 decades, the total required investment in the energy sector alone will be $3.5 trillion per year. That's nearly double Canada's GDP. Another $50 to $135 billion per year, quite the imprecise range, will be needed to develop and scale carbon capture and biofuel technology, both things, particularly carbon capture, that should be abandoned. The only reason they exist is to chase this myth that CO2, this invisible gas that comprises a mere fraction of our atmosphere, is the great pollutive enemy that we all must unify to fight. It's not. In biofuel technology. And more than 6 billion people, this is in 3 decades, will live in urban areas, and some 400 million homes are expected to be built in the next decade alone, all of which will require green technology and infrastructure to align with a net zero resilient transition. We're not talking about cheap, or if we are talking about cheap with green technology and net zero, we're talking about Hong Kong-style coffin homes, modular homes. You'll be living in sea cans. But this is the real clincher of this piece. 6 billion people will live in urban areas in the next 3 decades. Do you know how many people live in urban areas today? 4.4 billion. So he's preaching a religion that requires 1.6 billion people be relocated from the countryside to the cities. We're talking about social engineering unlike anything the world has ever seen before, and Mark Carney is one of its poster boy champions. We are talking about the coerced, a.k.a. forced, relocation of 1.6 billion people. Does anybody remember what happened when Stalin tried to move 12 or 13 million Ukrainians? Most of them ended up dead. 1.6 billion is orders of magnitude bigger, and they must, according to Mark Carney, come to reside in urban centers. They must get off the land. And they're going to do this multiple ways. If you're one of those high carbon producing farmers, you got to go. If you're a retiree living in your cottage on the lake, you got to go. You're a threat to the planet. If you're somebody who just enjoys the country life and you want to raise your kids away from the problems that these guys create in the cities, you got to go. One of the ways that they might start doing this coercion, they might start softly by taxing your home equity. Do you own your home outright? You're a threat to the planet. You must be taxed until it's unaffordable. And maybe they'll give carbon exemptions to people who produce mass-scale C-can apartment buildings. And you won't have to, the owner of the apartment building won't have to pay. Maybe the state will own it. I mean, he's talking about building 500,000 homes. How's he going to do that? Are we talking about mass-scale state housing? And housing is not really an accurate word because they're probably going to be these little miniature apartments, modular homes. Because you don't need space. You don't need a house larger than what the government is dictating for its climate needs. This is a pretty big deal. 1.6 billion people. Like, that's a lot worldwide. That's a lot. Social engineering on a scale we've never seen. We need, from the book, 50 Shades of Green, referencing 50 Shades of Gray. That's an interesting choice. 50 Shades of Green to catalyze and support all companies towards net zero and enable us to assess collectively whether we're Paris aligned, because there is no alternative. As with Say on Pay, where investors get to vote on executive compensation levels, there are growing calls for investors to have a say on transition, a vote on the adequacy of a company's preparedness for the transition to a net zero world. You don't have the alternative to not go along with the net zero transition. You only have a voice and a vote on how you're going towards it, because they're dictating the rules of the game. And your only choice is how you play the game, whose rules they dictate. That's one reason for the creation of the Glasgow Financial Alliance for Net Zero. GFANZ includes the world's biggest banks, asset owners, asset managers, and insurers. Again, not Main Street, not producers, not people who make things. This is the real world, to Mark Carney. Bringing together over 250 firms responsible for over $80 trillion of assets, and anchored in the race to zero, and it is the race to zero, not net zero, the race to zero prosperity, where there's oligarchs that sit above you, and they get to taste the fruits of the world, which will never meet your lips. Picture somebody in West Africa who grows cocoa, and they slave, and they sweat. Remember from earlier parts where we talked about people will need to reduce their carbon footprints to those of Chad and Niger, in order to meet these net zero targets. Picture somebody who slaves every single day to grow and harvest that cocoa, but has never tasted chocolate in their lives and will likely never be able to afford to. That's the future. That's the race to zero. And remember, Mark Carney is the guy who founded GFANZ and proudly proclaims that they represent $80 trillion in money, most of which, as he talks about in his book, earlier in this book, is money that's created from nothing. Central bankers and banks just create money. They loan it to you, and then you have to pay it back with your blood, sweat, and real money. And he's proud of this. This is his record. This is what he puts on his resume. Back to the book. As we have seen, a whole economy transition isn't only about funding deep green activities or blacklisting dark brown ones. That means investors cannot rely on simple green-brown taxonomies. They need 50 shades of green to catalyze and support all companies moving towards net zero. These are all highfalutin ideas, but right here, blacklisting dark brown ones. It's very clear that he wants to make it illegal, or if not illegal, certainly penalize anybody that wants to invest in makers versus those who just create money from nothing. Brown companies are anybody that produces energy. Brown companies are anybody that produce resource. You could say that brown companies are the farmers themselves that are a threat to the world. Back in the U.S. Wild West, the outlawed John Dillinger used to say that he robbed banks because that's where the money is. To get to net zero, financial institutions need to go where the emissions are and provide the capital to get them on track in the race to net zero. He picks an interesting analogy here about an outlaw, John Dillinger, comparing the financial institutions to an outlaw who have to target the emission producers and take them out. The edict from the book. To be clear, Companies' responsibility is first and foremost to reduce absolute emissions, not to produce things, not to make things, not to make your life better, not to improve the human condition, but to reduce emissions. But where they cannot, they should purchase credits to neutralize their residual emissions on the path to net zero. So you create a condition where if you have enough money, say you're a bank or a financial institution or a central bank that can just create money out of thin air, you should be able to purchase carbon credits so that you can go on living your life exactly as before and leave it to the plebs to make up the difference. To unlock this market, a private sector task force comprised of 250 organizations led by Bill Winters and Annette Nazareth, two rabbit holes, has created a blueprint for a professional global carbon credit market with the highest standards of integrity, transparency, and credibility that comes down from on high. The market has the potential to create significant co-benefits for biodiversity and other SDGs. This is technocratic stuff. This is top-down stuff. They talk about integrity, transparency, and credibility. They don't talk about democratic will. They don't talk about prosperity. They don't talk about your right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. This is the pursuit of net zero. And since Mark Carney is down meeting with Donald Trump today, and ostensibly we're about to enter a trade war over tariffs, I just want to highlight how since at least 2021, Mark has been in favor of tariffs from the book. In the meantime, carbon border adjustments, a form of tariff linked to relative climate effort, would allow leading countries to pursue more ambitious targets while avoiding carbon leakage. These adjustments should be designed in a way that is fully consistent with the WTO rules. Well, if you impose these carbon ideas, this climate extremism on the WTO, it should be pretty easy to conform when they're all on the same page. But this is a tariff that would be charged to penalize countries that aren't so carbon efficient, not just countries, but also companies. So Mark Carney loves tariffs. One should remember that today, but I don't think the Canadian public will. I don't think anybody, I have very little faith that the voters who voted for the Liberals and voted for Mark Carney actually understand anything about the man. Most of them never even picked up this book, let alone read it, because someone might have bought it. They would have read the first dozen or so pages and been like, it's over my head. And it sits on a bookshelf, unread. He tells you his plan. If ambitious climate targets are credible, businesses will limit investments in brown technologies, thereby reducing the stock of fully depreciated high-carbon machines to compete against green alternatives in the future. So this is a wordy way of saying that if all the technocrats come together and they discriminate against what he calls stock of fully depreciated high-carbon machines, which is the internal combustion engine, he tells you the truth later on in the book. Here he's still being clever. He hasn't fully taken the mask off. If there is huge regulatory pressure to phase out those businesses, there will be little to compete against green, and thus green will win, because he knows that green cannot win in a free market. It has to be backed by government. It has to be backed by the oligarchs, lest it would have to compete and it would fail, which is why we see so many green subsidies and so many subsidies and public money being thrown at ideas like carbon capture. They're not economically feasible. The markets he's talking about creating would never reveal themselves organically. They have to be imposed, and private money has to be marshaled by the public or by the banking class in the pursuit of those things. Otherwise, that private money would never spend itself in that way. Back to the book. First, the experience with inflation targeting demonstrates that in order to address a time inconsistency problem, the objective must be acknowledged by politicians across the political spectrum. Knowing that opposition parties are likely to implement similar policy also gives businesses the certainty that they need in order to invest in green infrastructure that has economic lifespans of several decades. This means that credible climate policies require broad political and public support. Buried in all those words is a kernel of truth. Opposition and government must be aligned. The differences between the two must be shrunk. The public must not be given a choice between prosperity and net zero. That way, the government, the markets, the money, all of the controlling interests know that there's alignment politically, so that there's only one path forward no matter how the public votes. He advocates for the degree of choice being reduced fundamentally in the pursuit of the climate religion. And he's open about it. He's telling you exactly what he plans to do. You must have a reduction in choice in order to meet his radical targets. Returning to the book for some of the most damning content, but governments can delegate certain aspects of the calibration of specific instruments necessary to achieve this target to carbon councils. C in carbon is capitalized, council is capitalized. These are extrajudicial, extra governmental. They sit above and beyond government. So essentially he's advocating for, even though there would be a limitation of choice, a reduction in choice between the political parties and his vision, it's not enough. The public can't be trusted to consistently vote against its own prosperity. That's one reason why the reduction in political choice must be achieved. But carbon councils would further devolve power away from the public and their elected representatives into these technocratic organizations, which would make the decisions to improve the predictability, credibility, and effectiveness of climate policies. So delegation away, out of the hands of the people, into the hands of technocracy in the pursuit of, quoting from the book, these tools include introducing enhanced environmental standards for manufacturing firms to accelerate, accelerating the phase out of the internal combustion engine. Make no mistake, anywhere there is an internal combustion engine, Mark Carney sees an enemy. Whether it's your generator, your car, your dirt bike, your ATV, your truck, anywhere that gasoline or diesel or natural gas burns and creates energy is something that Mark needs to see gone. It is his driving objective. He dedicated an entire part of his three-part book to it. A market in transition to 1.5 Celsius is being built. All of this is with the idea that you can control the temperature of the earth via all of these means. That natural forces are not at work. That the interglacial warm period that you live in right now, which enables our lives, where I sit, there should be a mile of ice above my head. But thankfully, it all melted over the last 10,000 years. That's actually a good thing. The warmth is not just good for humans, it's good for life. These guys are afraid of the heat. They're cold, and they want cold. And they believe that they can regulate the temperature by just targeting CO2. That natural forces don't outweigh man-made forces, even though their best evidence for that are a bunch of computer models, which are framed by the mathematics that they apply to them, which are framed by the IPCC, which does not allow alternative science into the equation. It is determinative. It has said, we have found that man is the principal driver of climate, and that's it. And if there's any evidence to the contrary, we don't hear it. And from that, they make policy that is then imposed by national governments on their people in pursuit of the objectives that Mark Carney spells out in his book, which most people, of the 8.5 million people who voted for him, don't even understand. So I think understanding the book, in particular, the forced relocation of 1.6 billion with a B, people worldwide into urban centers, imagine what that looks like. It's a socialism. It's a top-down technocracy. It's a totalitarianism bent on the climate cult, wrapped around the climate cult, involved in a myth, more or less, on a scale that we've never seen in world history. There's never been that many people alive to relocate. But this is the clearly spelled out objective of Mark Carney and his people. Congratulations, Canada. This is now our Prime Minister.